Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of December 14th. This week we feature an interview with Father Michael Ryan of the Archdiocese of Seattle. He's written the article, Why Don't We Wait? For the Current Issue of America, which is based on his Why Don't We Just Wait? Initiative, which is calling for a grassroots review of the new missal due to release in 2 years. We began our conversation with talking about Father Ryan's experience with the Latin liturgy and then about implementing the new English translations in the 1960s.
Well, I grew up with the Latin Mass. I think I could say my first 24 years were Latin Mass years. And so I knew it. And of course, I loved it in its own way. I was an altar boy. I learned the Latin responses in the fourth grade. You know, I learned them quickly, as kids are able to do. But I have to say, of course, what I learned were nonsense syllables. You know, the emphasis, as I recall from the sisters, were on proper pronunciation and proper recitation. There was no emphasis on meaning. Simply get those syllables out and, you know, do them in a way that Father won't object. So that was my beginning with the Latin Mass. And I, of course, later in the seminary when I was in college, the Latin became much more intelligible to me. But even then, I'd have to say, looking back, it was kind of a case of mental calisthenics, you know, sort of proving to myself that I could do this and that I could understand it. And to this day, I can still take out the old Roman Missal and read the Latin prayers and the blessings and the prefaces and the readings and find them completely intelligible. But I'd have to say, in doing that, for me, it's more of a performance than a prayer. It's not the way I talk to God, and it never will be. Thinking back to the parish church where I grew up, the experience of the Latin Mass for the people, myself included, was largely passive. It certainly was not participative. Even when we moved into what they called the Dialogue Mass, even that was not so much prayerful, but some kind of, again, I'll go back to my image of the mental calisthenics, that we can do this and do it together. But it was someone else's prayer, I think I'd put it that way. It certainly was not mine, and I don't think it was really the prayer of the congregation. It had, I will admit, a certain beauty and dignity to it, but it was maybe a frozen kind of beauty, maybe the kind of thing you might seek in a museum. Again, not the lively prayer life of a community. And I think because it was a passive experience, it encouraged a very individualistic, private kind of prayer, sometimes having little or nothing to do with what was actually going on in what we today would call the Eucharistic action. People were praying their rosaries, they were reading devotional prayer books, they were doing anything but becoming intimately engaged in the action that was taking place either at the ambo or at the altar. That just was not part of the equation.
Now, in your article, you start by describing the moment when the document, the Vatican II document on liturgy, was promulgated. Maybe you can just tell our listeners where you were and what that experience was like.
Yes, I was a young seminarian, my early 20s, I guess 24 maybe, at that time. I was studying in Rome. I, like so many, certainly in the church at that time, and surely so many of my contemporary seminary friends, we were all in St. Peter's Square for that day in December 8th, it was, 1963, when Pope Paul VI promulgated what was the very first document or constitution from the Second Vatican Council. The first session had produced nothing. This was the end of the second session, and what it produced was Sacrosanctum Concilium, the document on sacred liturgy. And so I was there, witnessed this moment, and knew in at least an incipient sort of way that this was a watershed moment, and I think we all did. We didn't know exactly what it would mean, but we knew it was something new and something different. I had heard a seminary rector only 3 years ago in Seattle when I was in college tell us that if we thought that we would ever see a vernacular liturgy in our time, we were dreaming. And here it was about 3 years later that bishops of the church, but the Pope with all the bishops and the whole world watching on proclaimed that this was a new moment. That wasn't the only thing, of course, that the council document proclaimed, but it made room for vernacular liturgy and, of course, a highly participative liturgy.
How were you involved in your own, you know, parish work in the implementation of this new liturgy, and what was that like?
Well, I came home a little late for the initial implementation because that was that took place actually in Advent of 1964. It only took 1 year for at least initial texts to be translated into the vernacular languages, including English. So that was exactly a year after the promulgation. I was still in Rome as a student. I didn't come home for two more years. So those initial efforts at implementation were, I only know them secondhand. I know that here in Seattle, for instance, the Archbishop quickly proclaimed himself to be a Vatican II bishop, which was a kind of surprise to many people because they thought of him as being kind of an old-style bishop. He was a wonderful man, but no one expected him to really embrace this in the way he did. And he did energetically and was eager for all the priests and all the people to come on board with this, and he wrote to them about it. He saw that his diocesan newspaper carried a series of articles explaining to people why they were doing it and why it would be better for their prayer life, etc., etc. So I think serious efforts were made to bring people on board. But I do also know that in 1964, when the first vernacular was introduced, it was a kind of an awkward thing because it was a back and forth. It was now English, now Latin, a kind of mixed message to the people. For instance, there was the old prayers at the foot of the altar still existed in Latin, but they were said quietly by the priest, and the people would be singing at the time. And then we had the Kyrie and Gloria. They were in English. Well, Kyrie in Greek, of course, but the Gloria in English. The Collect, though, the Collect prayer went right back to Latin. And then the readings were in English, and then the canon was entirely in Latin. The entire Eucharistic prayer was in Latin, but the Our Father was in English. And then the little prayer after the Our Father, the embolism, so-called, that went back into Latin. So it was this back and forth. Post-communion prayer was in Latin. So it had to have been a mixed message to people that it was good to have the vernacular, but not entirely good. I think it must have been difficult for people to see, although I'm told, and at least the reports I read, people said, well, it's wonderful to hear some of our own language.
That language, the English, where did that translation initially come from? Who did it?
I should be more up on that particular issue. I don't think ISIL had been formed yet. So it was done by a committee put together by the bishops of this country, I believe. I don't even think it was done in cooperation with other English-speaking nations or peoples. So it was done by, you know, there were certainly liturgical experts whom the bishops quickly employed to come up as quickly as possible with serviceable translations.
And ISIL, just for those who might not be familiar, was the eventual organization that was formed among English-speaking countries to come up with a translation that could be used in these countries.
Exactly.
And now where things stand is that they have been in the process of, I mean, there has been this long process to revise the Roman Missal. Was the initial idea that the first translation would eventually be revised, and that's the step we're at right now?
I believe the bishops, even back then, knew that this was provisional, what they adopted in 1964. And I do remember I was back home in the States by 1967, and I recall it was around 69 that another step was taken, the Eucharistic prayer, against all odds, was put into the vernacular. I remember preparing the people in the parish where I served as an assistant at the time. We did a series of talks about this for the people to help them understand that even this most sacred part of the Mass was now going to be in their own language. But yes, we had we moved gradually into more use of the vernacular. And then ISIL, the International Committee on English and the Liturgy, was formed, and then they undertook a more international look at translations.
So where things stand now, I mean, obviously there's been a long back and forth here that we can't get into, and you don't really get into your article, but there is this new set of translations that is due to be implemented in the United States fairly soon. What was your initial reaction when you saw these translations?
Well, I'd have to say my initial reaction was not good. I did try to keep an open mind. But I knew that the work of ISIL, and now when we say ISIL, I think we have to distinguish because there was the ISIL that in 2002 was totally repopulated. So I knew that the, let's call it the old ISIL, had worked for 15 years to produce new and better translations than the ones we began with. It was a long, long process, and they presented them to the Holy See in 1998 and then heard nothing for 4 years, to 2002. So I knew that they had worked on these. I had seen some examples of them, and I was encouraged by them. They seemed to be beautiful and reflective of scholarship, but also of people who really appreciated English language. But I knew that all of that had been thrown out by the Holy See in 2002, and a new liturgical set of principles was put into place by the Vatican. No longer could the translations use what we called, or what ISIL called and others and the Holy See called, positively, dynamic equivalents, meaning that you look for the meaning, you know, you translate meanings more than just words. No longer could we do that. We had to be formally equivalent to the Latin. In other words, we had to adhere to the Latin with almost a kind of slavish literalism. So I knew all of that as background when I saw the new translations, that they were a product of this new look at what translations should be. Even so, I tried to keep an open mind. But that was hard to do after I began reading them. You know, I don't know what to say except that they, and I'm not going to tar them all with the same brush. Some, I think, are worthy and many are not. But they tend to be heavily Latin in their sound and in their feel. For instance, the Lord be with you and with your spirit. Well, that certainly reflects the Latin. Et cum spiritu tuo, no one will deny that. But 40 years of saying, and also with you, it would seem to be a needless and jarring kind of invasion of people's prayer to get them to say that and feel that it meant anything to them. We don't speak that way, and with your spirit. Or a word like in the Creed, we say one in being with the Father when we proclaim the Creed. Now we have the Latin, consubstantial with the Father. Someone asked me, Father, what does consubstantial mean? I said, well, it means one in being with. Why don't we stay with one in being? The Eucharistic prayer, Jesus, you know, takes the cup. And that's, of course, the word that's used in the scriptures, the gospel narratives of the Last Supper. He took the cup. But no, we have the reflection of the old Roman canon, which did not translate the scripture. We have the precious chalice, which, again, I think people are going to shake their heads. Did Jesus really use a precious chalice? This simple, humble, you know, man, this carpenter from Nazareth, did he, this itinerant preacher, carry around a precious cup with him? Or the very, very jarring part of the Eucharistic prayer where the in the consecration of the wine and the phrase for many instead of for all. You know, did Jesus die for many or did he die for all? Well, the Holy See has insisted that it has to be for many because the old Latin of the Roman canon said pro multis, for many. Even though we know from scripture scholars that the meaning of that is for all, we know that Christ died for all. So why would we visit these Latinate phrases on people simply out of a fidelity to a language that never was the language of Christ, certainly, and it was not the language of the early church. It came along a good bit later. Why would we visit this on people centuries and centuries later? That's a big question. And then we have these ungainly, lengthy sentences that will be very difficult for presiders to read, and I would say even more difficult for the people to interpret and to understand. Some of them are not even sentences. They're fragments. They're dangling participles without even a verb, which is quite an assault on the English language. Awkward syntax and grammar, certainly more Latin than English. And, you know, for the musicians and composers, no metric sense at all. For the Gloria, for instance, I would hate to be the one having to try to set the new Gloria to music in a way that will work. So we have all this kind of antiquarianism all around Latin that, to me, when I actually saw the product, I thought to me, myself, this does not work. And I'm the more I read, the more I see, the more I believe it. How many times do you use the word ignominy or suffused or oblation or unvanquished or ineffable? We just don't use those kinds of words, and yet they're laced throughout these texts. And I think people will scratch their heads and say, why are they doing this to us?
Yes, in your article, Why Don't We Just Say Wait for America and the Current Issue, you mentioned that you've shared some of the, in your conversations with parishioners and also with friends, these are the reactions you're getting, that
exactly.
People are either just, they're wondering why, you know, why use a word that is not often used in place of something that's fairly common. Also, sometimes people, as you described in one instance, react with laughter, which is not the reaction you want to get in the context of the liturgy.
Certainly not. And I use an example of that in the article, as you say. Spouse of the same virgin, you know, instead of Joseph, her husband, you know. There was audible laughter in a room full of priests and pastoral ministers, and you can imagine what it might trigger in more in the actual celebration of the liturgy. This was a workshop. But yes, I'm afraid there's going to be a lot of that, and it's so unfitting. You know, and the whole notion that somehow we need more sacral language, I think we need dignified language, beautiful language, poetic language, but sacred language? I'm not sure that Jesus used a lot of sacred language. You know, he talked in parables. He spoke in simple ways that people could understand. Why wouldn't we want to do the same?
Maybe you could tell us about the Why Don't We Just Say Wait project, which you introduce in your article.
Sure. Why don't we just say wait? I think it's my whole notion there is that we have time still. You know, the bishops have signed off on these translations, I think, with progressive resignation. I don't think at the beginning they ever really realized what they were getting into. In 2006, when they did approve it, rather surprisingly, they did so with the understanding that there were going to be a lot of amendments that they had passed on that would go to Rome and be accepted, and so they thought they could live with that. So they passed that was in 2006, and Bishop Troutman, who has been such a hero in this thing, he cheered that moment because he thought, yes, we're getting the new translations, but they're going to have our spin on them, and yet when they got to Rome, not so. Rome rejected most of the suggestions, most of the ones that seemed most sensible, I would say. So they passed them again this in Washington, another set of the translations. And now they're in the hands of the Holy See, or soon will be, and they'll come back to us whenever that might be, I suppose later this year. And I'm thinking we have this time, and only this time, between now and when they come back to us, for some kind of grassroots effort to be to take place that might say, let's wait before we do this. It's not rejecting the translations. It's saying, let's test them in a mature way that gets reaction from the people in the pews, the priests who have to promote them and who will be praying them with the people. Let's step back and give people in a kind of controlled pilot project an opportunity to say, they work, they don't work, this is what we like, this is what we don't like. We do that with lots of things. I call it market testing. It's a very American thing. I'm not sure in Rome it's very appreciated, but it certainly is the way we do things, and when we want to do them well, we do that sort of thing very carefully. And I'm saying, let's wait and do that kind of thing before we impose these, you know, as a straitjacket on all the people of the English-speaking world, and probably set ourselves up for what South Africa experienced a year ago.
Which was, they were a little early in implementing these, and there was this strong reaction.
Exactly. They were early. They misread, apparently, the instruction from the Holy See, and they implemented them after catechesis, after preparing the people. The Southern Cross is an independent Catholic newspaper down in South Africa, and an editorial just a few months ago, they asked a question which I think it would be wise for our bishops and others to take into account, and I quote, "Perhaps our experience is a caution to the rest of the English-speaking world, but will the Vatican take note and learn from it?" And then Bishop Kevin Dowling of the Diocese of Rustenburg in South Africa went at great lengths to critique the whole process. I thought he was very courageous to do so, but he did so. He spoke up. He talked about texts being imposed. He talked about the thinking faithful and the priests. We should not expect that they will simply accept what is imposed on them from above. He talked about the bishops ought to stand their ground and claim their own collegial identity as bishops and not just let things be forced. So, I mean, he was reflecting what happened down there when people said, no, we don't want this. There's a wonderful story about a Redemptorist priest. He was giving some kind of a presentation to 50 different liturgists and lay ministers, and he asked them, you know, what it was that they wanted most, and he said the response came, you know, universally, give us back our Mass the way we had it before. And these are people who were prepared for the new thing, but rejected it.
when you talk about we, why don't we just say, wait, are you talking about the bishops, priests, or the laity as well?
Well, you know, when I started this, I was thinking about a kind of call for my brother priests, because we are, of course, the ones who are going to be asked to promote this and to prepare people for it. It kind of it rests on our shoulders to make this thing work. The bishops know that, of course, and I think they're a little nervous about it. Because I think many of them know that there's anything but uniform support for this. So my first thought was, let's get the priests. We don't really have a national voice anymore. We did at one time through various bodies, but not so much anymore. But to find a way to get to the priests and say, let's stand up together and say, wait before we do this. But the more I thought about it, of course, I think we need to involve the people. After all, it's their prayer. It's our prayer together with them, and I think their voice should be heard too. And we ought to take into account the fact that our people are intelligent, and they have a voice, and they should be able to claim their baptismal birthright and should be consulted. And they have not been consulted, except maybe in the rarest of circumstances where a bishop might have given a set of texts to a layperson. But in the main, they were not only not consulted, I would say 95% of them don't even know what's about to be visited on them or imposed on them.
Now, what you're calling for, you know, some people may see as almost an act of civil disobedience. Why do you see such strong action required on this question and not other perhaps contentious issues of church teaching?
Well, first of all, I would be the last one to say that we don't need strong action on other areas of church life. We do. I simply chose to address this particular one. The Eucharist is, after all, you know, the heart of our prayer. It's the source and summit of our prayer. It kind of makes us who we are. It defines us. So it's pretty central. But I would also have to say that we need strong action on a lot of things. I think the bishops should be taking strong action on defending their rights to collegiality within the church, because I think that's gradually being eroded. I think the church needs to be dealing with women's issues and shortage of priest issues and bioethical issues and issues of human sexuality. It goes on and on and on. So no, I just happen to have, I'm a pastor of a large parish, you know, some 2,600 families who come to this large cathedral church every Sunday from all over the county, and actually several counties, 150 zip codes, and they love to pray in this place. They pray together beautifully, and they don't know that their prayer together is about to have an awful assault committed against it. And so that's why I took this one. I really wanted to defend my people and our people against something that I think is unwarranted.
And would you describe it as civil disobedience?
I wouldn't call it civil disobedience. For one thing, nothing has been mandated yet. We don't have something from Rome yet saying that we must do this, although I must say I've heard tell of priests in South Africa who are saying they've refused to make some of the changes, they will not. That would be a form of civil disobedience, I suppose. I don't think we've gotten to that point right yet. I think it's more a question of some dialogue, some listening, some learning, and trying to, again, I use the word again, claim our birthright. The Vatican Council did assure the people of the church that they must have a voice and they need to speak to their leaders, and so I don't call that disobedience. I think it's being intelligent about our Catholicism and claiming our birthright.
Finally, what's the timetable here? When are the new translations due to be implemented?
Well, I'm told that they will probably come back from the Holy See sometime in 2010, and the plan is that they be implemented in the parishes across the English-speaking world in Advent of 2011, so about exactly 2 years from now, which again is another reason to say, wait, we have some time. But I don't know that as an insider. That's what the word on the street is, that 2011 Advent would be the time when these would be generally imposed.
Well, Father Michael Ryan from Seattle, thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
And thank you for the opportunity. It was a pleasure.
We want to thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the American Magazine podcast. You can learn more about the Why Don't We Just Wait project at whydon'twejustwait.org. Also online this week, look for our Advent video series, Reflections on Art. This week, Father Leo Donovan reflects on the windows of the Chartres Cathedral, especially the Tree of Jesse. We also have an art review by Father John Coleman about an exhibit of narrative paintings at the Metropolitan Museum. We want to thank Bill McGarvey, who provides the music for this week's show. You can learn more about him at billmcgarvey.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.